You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, the podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you guys so much for downloading and listening. If you've been listening to and enjoying our little podcast, please consider helping the show out by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island to learn more. All right, let me just tell you a little bit more about that Patreon thing there. If you think this podcast is worth $5 a month to you, I invite you to support the podcast by becoming a patron of the show. You can go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island. There you can sign up. If you become a patron, you get exclusive access to an online live chat during the U.S. broadcast of each new episode of The Curse of Oak Island. And that chat is the highlight of my week. It really is. And I'll tell you, you guys who have been taking part in that chat, you patrons, you've really stepped up your game this year. It has been something else. Again, folks, if you want to support the podcast, $5 a month, cancel anytime, patreon.com/diggin' oak island. You can sign up. If you also want to make a one-time donation, and thank you to everyone who has, it is really humbling for all of you guys who've joined the Patreon page, who've sent in donations. You've really helped. You've helped me improve everything I have here equipment-wise. It's the reason why I'm able to get things out, you know, within 48 hours of the show as often as I possibly can because of the equipment I've been able to get, thanks to you guys. Anyway, if you want to make a one-time donation, the only way I can do that is Venmo. Just use the username at Dave McBride Music. I'm a musician by trade. That's sort of a way I take payment or tips or things like that. Venmo at Dave McBride Music. All right. A couple of things I want to mention here. First is a little PSA. I am recording this 2 hours after I got a colonoscopy. So listen, don't question my devotion here, folks, to the Oak Island mystery or this podcast. I'm doing fine. Everything's great. My brother actually came down with colon cancer 5 or 6 years ago. So I have to go every 5 years. And I just want to encourage you guys and everyone out there who is, you know, of a certain age, talk to your doctor. The doctor has told me before that if my brother was just a few years younger, he would have had his first colonoscopy and they would have caught this before it got really bad. Thankfully, my brother is doing incredibly well 6 years later. It's amazing to hear him. He runs a podcast. He runs two, actually. He does one on Disney's Animal Kingdom called Radio Harambe, which I used to be part of. But now he does it with his wife, Christina. And he's also part of a fantastic sports cast called Perishable Sports with a guy named Matt Parrish, who is just a terrific podcaster. So check both of those out and go get your colonoscopy. Also, I know that a lot of you have sent in questions, comments, asking me what I think about a recent interview on another podcast, whose name's escaping me right now, that was with Jeremy Church. He's the guy who did the analysis of the seismic surveys that they did on Oak Island a couple years back. You remember this guy, right? He's the guy with the ship-shaped anomaly thing, right? I have not had time yet to go through this entire interview, which is quite lengthy. It's a big, long interview, and I will get to it. I want to focus on the remainder of the show here because they've been throwing a lot of different stuff at us the last few weeks. I don't want to get too distracted off on that, you know, on a tangent there about the swamp and the geology and all that. Plus, I'm not a geologist, so it takes me a long time to kind of understand everything that's coming in here. Hopefully, we'll come back to that after season 11 ends. We'll get a good look at that interview and some of the things he said. Like I said, I know a lot of you have asked about that. If you've seen it, if you have any questions or any comments, send them in at diggin' oak island@gmail.com, and we will save them until we can spend the time to talk about it a little bit. So anyway, you're going to have to do a little search for it. I can't remember the name of the podcast that it's on. If I think of it, I'll put it in the Facebook page. It is a really good podcast. Jeremy Church is probably still under some non-disclosure agreement stuff, which you can kind of hear in this interview. So, I don't want to pass any judgment on anything he said here because I haven't watched it all yet. And I know some of you have. So anyway, just put that one aside. Let's get to your emails now that do not have to do with the Jeremy Church interview. And we begin with Katie, who writes, "Hi, Dave. Katie from Leicestershire, England." I think it's Leicestershire, right? "Just dropping a quick question to you regarding the latest episode. The logs they found in the garden shaft, I found very interesting when they said they could find evidence of walls or they couldn't find evidence of a walls or a floor. Could this be an undiscovered platform set every 10 feet, meaning that the garden shaft is the original money pit? Looking forward to the next podcast and your thoughts. Thanks, Katie." Katie, that answer could come with the dating of the wood, right? Which we have yet to get. From the looks of these pieces, unfortunately, though, they can't be dated using dendrochronology, which is the only way to really get a good, accurate dating. Carbon dating is, as we've all seen, is just way too inaccurate. If this was chopped down and used as a searcher in 1805 or whatever it is, we could be, or even the 1820s, we'll get this range in the carbon dating that dates from 1701 to 1886, and then they'll go crazy about the 1701, right? So it's hard to do it. I'm not sure where we'll go with this, but let's hang on for that. The potential is there for what you're hoping for here, right? Because, hey, this is the first time we've seen a platform, right? And it doesn't seem to make any sense. But let's not get in front of our skis too much because there's a lot more to go here. Again, this platform seems to fit that original story of the money pit discovery, if you believe those stories. But again, we're just going to have to sit tight here a little bit. Great question, Katie. Thank you for writing. And when we get some more answers, come back to me with some more here. Let's go now to Brian, who writes, "Hello, Dave. Been a while since I wrote in, but a thought crossed my mind today that with all the talk of Vikings and Templar connections, remember the bone pieces they found in the money pit area? The fact that one of them had distinct Middle Eastern DNA was an anomaly, or so it seemed. Now, couple that with the purported Scandinavian pieces creates an interesting narrative. Maybe the bones were part of the depositing crew and came over in that Viking Templar flotilla. I say this with more than a little pessimism, but at this point, who knows? Love the podcast and still look forward to it every week. Thanks, Brian in Minnesota." Brian, great stuff. Listen, sure, I guess it's possible that this could be the result of a Templar Viking flotilla where someone from the Middle East joined in. I of course, anything is possible. But the problem is there was no Templar Viking flotilla that we know of. And still, even after last week, there's really no concrete evidence of a Viking Templar connection at all, for that matter. What we have, to put it in the most, in the snarkiest way, right? What we have is a remote possibility that a future knight, Templar knight, met with a Norwegian king, not a Viking king, a Norwegian king. And 200 years later, the Templars were able to use some secret navigational information learned in that meeting to help them cross the Atlantic. Assuming, of course, that the Vikings made it all the way to Nova Scotia, which, again, there is absolutely nothing to say they did. So it's a little thin. You see what I'm getting? This was the king of Norway. Again, this was not a Viking. There is a difference. And any Templars he could have met would have been dead for hundreds of years by the time this knowledge would have been used within the theory of the Templars' escape from Europe that we're talking about. But on a good note, what we got last week, in my mind, is the beginning of a theory. It's the beginning of a possibility, but it's just the beginning, and one that has many, many steps left on the journey here. We're only at step 2 or 3, and we've got 100 miles to go. So, you know, we can't really worry about anything too concrete just yet. We got to see what comes out of all this. But like I said last week, it's a start. Let's hear now from Scott, who writes, "Dave, you continue to do a fantastic job with your podcast." Thank you, Scott. You're welcome. Thank you for saying that. He continues, "Despite the fact that the show can be frustrating, it's the only show that is not a sporting event that my wife and I plan our life around." I got to stop here. That used to be, Scott, exactly the case for me and my wife. She gave up on the show about 3 years ago. I'm glad yours has not yet, because those were great times. Anyway, she just sort of walks around and does her whatever, gets the kid ready for bed and makes some snarky comment about the way Gary carries on about ox shoes or whatever she talks about. Anyway, Scott continues, 11 years and millions of dollars spent on this little island, and we have more questions than answers. There simply has to be a reason so much work was done on this island. Thousands of man hours spent here. Why? There simply has to be a reason. Brave and very competent men decided to work here rather than go a few hundred yards to the mainland where the vast resources of Canada could be taken advantage of. The Vikings could have easily stopped on the island, which could explain the vast discrepancies in the dates the Lagina crew has encountered in their investigations. History indicates when the Vikings created settlements, it was because of economic opportunities in the area. I just don't see any such opportunities on this little island. In any case, I think I'm stating the obvious. Thank you for joining us in our Oak Island addiction, Scott. Scott, in its entire documented history, we know for sure that the only economic opportunity that we know of, for sure, that was ever exploited on the island was farming, specifically livestock. Now, if you read about Samuel Ball, many people who write who aren't really historians, but just sort of, you know, Oak Island fans, will tell you that Samuel Ball became a filthy rich cabbage farmer or something like that. But the fact is, he was not at all filthy rich. And also, we don't really know for sure what he actually farmed. We have no documentation that says he farmed cabbage on the island. We have no archaeological proof, nothing that says that. So if you think about that, livestock kind of makes more sense, right? You just leave some cows over there. You don't need to worry about losing them. No one is rowing over to steal one. And the ocean kind of works as a pretty foolproof fence, right? Fishing makes some sense for this island, but not as much as you would think if you start to really think about it. The problem is, why would they use this island, Oak Island, for such a thing? I mean, it's so close to the mainland. As you say, why not just use the mainland? And if it was you were using an island for convenience sake, right? Because you wanted to find a good landing spot further out to sea to cut down your sail to unload the fish from your boat, you wouldn't use this island. It's right next to the shore. And, you know, you could practically swim to the mainland from it. There are dozens of islands that fit that bill way better and further out into the bay and bigger. If fishermen wanted to find an island to avoid entanglements with local First Nations people, again, you know, which is true for a lot of early fishing settlements along the North Atlantic coast of America, of North America, why would you use this island? Because it's so, again, it's so close to the mainland. It is in itself kind of an easy target when you can pick one of dozens of others further out to sea and, again, a little bit bigger. Along the same lines, if you think about it, if you wanted to hide a treasure and keep it secret from the world forever, man, they didn't pick a very good island for that either, right? And finally, Scott, is it conceivable the Vikings came to Oak Island? Sure, it's conceivable, but I don't know about the word easily. Like we talked about last week, the only place we know they actually landed was in the very northeastern tip of Newfoundland. I mean, as close to Greenland as you could possibly get, and very, very far away from Oak Island. We like to think it's not. It is. It's very far away from Oak Island. Newfoundland is a big, big rock in the middle of the ocean. And listen, I'm no expert on Viking history, right? But as far as I know, the Vikings weren't exploring around looking for things. They were looking for economic opportunities, right? They were looking for money and riches and maybe women. I don't, you know. So why would they have stopped on Oak Island? You know, it just doesn't, none of it makes any sense at this point to me. And then there are a lot of other holes in the whole Viking Templar connection, especially in that, you know, what we mentioned a few times about the Templars not actually, the Vikings not actually staying with the Templars in the Holy Land, which we're going to get to in just a second. Thank you for writing in, Scott. You've given me some stuff to think about here, and I just want to get right into this email from our friend Mark in Calgary because it kind of goes along with what you're saying here. He writes, "Hey, Dave, just some random thoughts as I watched the episode. Not really sure why a professor in psychology would be an expert on Viking-Templar connections, But a quick internet search learns that Sigurd, the king of Norway, who we talked about last week, left his men and ships in Constantinople, Istanbul, who went to join the emperor's Varangian Guard, whatever that is. Get to it in a second. And so not Jerusalem, as the good man is saying. Okay, I'm going to stop here. All right, Mark, you got me. You reeled me in. The Varangian Guard, or however you pronounce it, was a sort of like a secret service, the personal protector, so to speak, of the Byzantine emperors throughout this age. They were made up of mostly Northern European recruits, right, who were basically brought in there because, specifically because they were not from the local area. So they had no political ties to the empire and therefore were sort of much more trustworthy in the eyes of emperors, right? Nobody's going to get in their ear and tell them they're not doing something and we should kill the emperor. So that's what they are. And if you think about the connection here, you really see where the mistake was made in last week's crackpot session, because this makes all the sense in the world. Some of the Vikings stayed not in Jerusalem, but in Constantinople, where they were actually given a job and where they were recruited to do something. So, again, a little bit of a hole. Last week's top one was very interesting, but tough sometimes to kind of get through the holes in it. Anyway, Mark continues. That said, it is very possible Sigurd and his men had a pint or two with the early Templars. Can't imagine Jerusalem being that big at the time with a lot of pubs. Also, I'll have a swig of my whiskey and refrain from commenting on boats in the swamp. Love all the underground work in the Garden Shaft and on Lot 5, though. Quick thing on Nolan's Cross and the alignments. I think surveyors nowadays would struggle with creating a perfect alignment like that. Don't forget, Google Earth assumes the world is a sphere. I Googled it. And it is not, of course. It's a disc. Now, and Mark and I went back and forth. The disc isn't really the right word. It's something else. I forget what it is, but you get what he's saying. It's because it's not perfectly round. It's pulled on the edge, on the poles, by gravitational forces. Anyway, he continues. Now, for a moment, look at some old maps from ye olden days when Nolan's Cross was supposedly created. Do those maps inspire confidence they could survey that accurately back then? Determining where you are on the planet is really hard, especially longitude. It was not until the advent of reliable chronometers that we could do it. Galileo found a way to do it with the moons of Jupiter, but that was well after the supposed creation date of the cross. Also, accuracy of the method is in hundreds of meters. Anytime the cross is mentioned, I always think back to one of your interviews with Gordon Fader. Paraphrasing here, he said something along the lines of, there were enough boulders on Oak Island for several crosses and a chicken. Did he say chicken? Do you think if we supplied the coordinates of the chicken to Gaspini, he'd find a celestial alignment dating back to the 1200s? Lots of stars up there. I find most of Nolan's stuff suspect. He allegedly discovered the cross in the early 1980s, but teased it for a decade before releasing any evidence. He was also suspended from the Nova Scotia Land Survey action for tampering with survey evidence on Oak Island. Tampering with survey evidence is illegal under Canada's Survey Act. I think that speaks to his character. Anyways, last few episodes have been great. If anyone was wondering, my degree is in geodesy, unlike many other things. Surveying, I do know. Cheers, Mark in Calgary, Canada. Mark, I just want to say a couple of things. First thing that comes to mind is when you made a quick mention of, look at the maps from ye olden days when Nolan's Cross was supposedly created. Do they inspire confidence that they could survey that accurately back then? My God, Mark, what a point. No, by no means do they inspire that kind of confidence. And everything else is so well said. I just want to talk a little bit more a bit about something you said there. Your quote is, do you think if we supplied the coordinates of the chicken to Professor Gasparini, he'd find a celestial alignment dating back to the 1200s? Now, Mark, you have a wonderful way of, and a very fun way of making what really is a great point here. This is what happens when the worlds of treasure hunters, television producers, and archaeologists collide, right? Everyone on your screen that you're seeing has something to gain by furthering the idea of a treasure. And specifically for Oak Island, they also have something to gain by furthering an idea of the treasure being put there by the Knights Templar or the Vikings or something unknown to history that could really drive ratings, right? So could the professor find a chicken? You know, probably yes. Because here's what happens when you have people doing this kind of work. They're looking for one, right? They're looking for something to help achieve the goals of the show. They're looking for the alignment. Do I think that means the professor is lying or purposely fabricating evidence? I do not. But a lot of times, let me give you an example. If you go looking for ghosts and you hear strange knocks and see strange shadows, which probably in the long run are nothing more than shadows and knocks and not really a ghost. But the thing is, you went into the house convinced that you might find a ghost. So lo and behold, that's what you find. Am I making sense with this? Sometimes I think what happens here is we're looking for evidence of the Templars. We're looking for evidence of a treasure. So we find it because we convince ourselves that we found it, even though maybe that's not what we're actually looking at. That happens a lot when you have these kind of things. Just look at any Bigfoot show. Okay, folks, that's all for the emails today. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments, send them along to diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Okay, it's time now to discuss Season 11, Episode 18 of The Curse of Oak Island called Hi-Ho Silver. You know, and I'm just going to get this out of the way right here. After two really great episodes in a row, I mean, two really fantastic episodes, to me, this one kind of didn't hit that standard, didn't come up to that standard, if I'm honest. The biggest problem I had, and maybe this is just me, but it seemed like there was more recapping and of previous work than even there normally is. And the patrons in the live chat seem to kind of agree with me. Steve said, quote, between the recaps and long commercials, one can fast forward through the show in about 20 minutes on a DVR. And then Elizabeth added, quote, the constant recaps is what causes me to tune out of most of each episode. And I get why the show does this. And I usually don't notice it. And I usually don't worry about it too much because I'm taking notes. Right. And I'm writing things down as I'm watching the show for the podcast. So when he gets into the recap is when I'm catching up with notes. Right. Maybe it's easier for me because I don't really see some of it. But this week, it just seemed like a lot more, an unusual amount to me of just looking back and recapping and B-roll footage from the History Channel. And content wise, I got to also say there really wasn't much for me to expand on here in the podcast. But, you know, let's give it a go. As Gary says, let's get stuck in. Let's start at the money pit. Not much going on here this week, so we're going to just kind of go through this area quickly. There's a meeting at the garden shaft with, I think, Roger 14 from Dumas, who tells them that they've dug the shaft down to 102 feet, and they're looking to go further down all the way to 106 feet, at which point they'll begin a horizontal exploratory drilling project to try and find this elusive tunnel. As I've said the last couple of weeks, we went a long time in this season, hearing that the garden shaft was going to be extended down to 95 feet, despite that being well short of an elusive tunnel, a supposed tunnel that they have been finding down there. Well, all of that is for naught. They're actually extending it down to this target depth. Anyway, that's all there really was for the money pit. So let's head over to the swamp, which is starting to get really interesting again, if not a touch frustrating, at least certainly today. And everyone on the Patreon knows what I'm talking about already. Billy, Rick, and Jack are again at this wooden feature from last week. Amazingly, they're still digging this thing out. Still digging out what they claim is an unknown wooden feature, an old feature, possibly a dam, that according to the narration and the guys, could have been used to create the swamp in an incredible effort to make a swamp, to hide a ship and part of the treasure and yada, yada, yada. And they're digging this thing out with a humongous excavator. Now, again, for the patrons who are on the live chat, maybe I was beating this drum a bit too much and I apologize for that. But it is starting at this point to drive me nuts. We're seeing posts, we're seeing dowels, we're seeing planks, we're seeing all sorts of stuff. And we're told nobody knows what it is and where it's coming from. And instead of bringing in an archaeologist to do a real thorough investigation and excavation here, for the show to know exactly what this feature will look like, looked like at the time, they're tearing it apart with this giant implement of destruction. I'm sorry, guys. This is driving me nuts. Anyway, let's continue. One of the guys mentions that Gary has found no metal fasteners, no nails or spikes of any kind around this feature. That's strange for sure. But apparently they have found what they think are wooden dowels, although we only get sort of this quick image, I think, even that, of what might be a dowel. So who knows? They haven't really made a point of that. Rick then finds some pottery that is smashed to bits. I hope not by the excavator. Stop, I promise. And then he hopes that this pottery could be dated. However, we don't see any of that analysis on this episode, so let's see if they come back to that later in the season. We know there are two or three people on the other side of the island that can do a pretty good job with helping you with that anyway, so maybe we'll talk to them next week. One of the guys then mentions, then later Gary comes to start detecting around these dirt piles, and he pulls out a piece of, you know, wood, which he looks certain, even to me, to be a barrel stave. So a barrel stave is one of those long pieces that makes up the body of the barrel or the keg. So you have the long, you know, vertical pieces that are held together by the hoops that go around it, right? That's what the stave is. So he finds something like that. And what follows then is a lot of talk about maybe whoever deposited the treasure put it in these barrels, I guess for no other reason than to try to make this pretty mundane finds seem treasure related in some way. Folks, just stop for a second and think about this, right? Think about what they're trying to say. The Knights Templar squirreled the most precious religious artifacts in the history of the Western world out of Europe, then sailed them basically into the unknown to hide them. And in order to do this, you're trying to tell me they stuck them into barrels and buried them 10 yards from the ocean? I don't think so. Something's missing in all this. Anyway, later on, towards the end of the episode, Dr. Spooner comes to have a look at this wooden feature. Honestly, I'm a little confused why Spooner would be looking at this. Isn't this more of the wheelhouse of an archaeologist than a geologist? I certainly understand why he'd be looking at the ground and those things. Perfect for that. But why not have Laird Niven come over and take a look? Either way, Spooner says the right thing here, and he tells them, as he puts it, to stand down. Stop digging away with this giant excavator, and let Steve Guptill come in and at least plot this all out so we can see how it fits onto the map. Hopefully, the part where he said to them, and stop destroying this thing with an excavator, was simply edited out. Again, I broke my promise. I went back at it. That's the end of the excavator. Anyway, later Gary is detecting spoils again with Jack Begley. He pulls out a big dirty piece of metal, which he says could possibly be part of a tool. Hard to see from the images we get. He later finds a spike. So are we now saying they are finding fasteners here? And what does that mean? Anyway, we don't see any analysis on either of these finds. And you know what I like to say, folks. If we don't hear from these things again, we know why. But this year, they've been circling back to these things, so maybe they will in a future episode. All right, let's go now over to Lot 5. Work here actually begins at the lab, with a look at what seemed like a very old and rather large spike that they found last week. Emma Culligan works her little magic and is able to tell from its chemical makeup to conclude that it is indeed hand-wrought, which means that it is pretty old. She then says that, again, through the chemical makeup, that it not only is it hand-wrought and could be old, but there's this weirdly edited scene where she says, but it could be very, very old. Now, the editing, again, here is truly bad in my mind, really confusing, because she first says 1500s to 1700s, but then kind of also adds in like 1100s to 1300s. Yet the show gives us absolutely no context as to what she means by any of this, how she comes to these conclusions. Is there any way to differentiate? Why would it be one set and not the other? Is there any way they can tell? Listen, Steve on the Patreon, and the other Steve, not the one we mentioned before, remarked, quote, Emma Culligan is truly impressive. And my goodness, is Steve correct? This This woman is brilliant, and she might be the single best addition to the cast that they've brought in since Laird Niven. And for that reason alone, I'm 100% sure she didn't just leave it all like that, like it's old, but it could be really, really old, and maybe, who knows, you know, without providing any context or anything really to sort of make any, you know, any idea of what she's talking about. I just can't see her saying that. You know, I'm sure she provided the context, but the show wants to focus on the 1100s thing since that fits the Templar theory, which the focus is sort of on for the show at this moment. Interestingly, Laird mentions that he and Emma have absolutely no idea what this spike is. He knows it's not a fastener, I guess, because it's too thin and too long. It's not a spike, but he genuinely has no clue what this could be and what it's used for. And since we also have what appears to be a 600-year range in its possible age, my guess is we may never learn, right? It's kind of interesting to me that we didn't bring Carmen Legg in to see this particular piece because of that range of dates and because of sort of nobody on the island knowing what it could have been used for. But again, maybe we circle back to this. Maybe this is something we see again later on. So let's hang on to that one. So next, we're back on Lot 5. And they're over, the archaeologists are at the foundation feature, which was circular, now rectangular. It's Jamie Kuba and Fiona Steele. They're doing their thing there. Jamie pulls out what she thinks is a gold-plated button. And then she pulls out later a small piece, sort of, you know, 3 inches long of silver, which she refers to as silverware. At first, it looks like it would be like sort of a silver decorative end to something else. You know what? I have no idea, but like the top of a spoon or something. I have no idea. So they bring it back to the lab, both of these things back to the lab to show Emma and Laird. Emma seems pretty sure about the button that it's British military and from the 18th century. And Laird seems to agree. But Laird also adds that I guess because we really can't get a good look at some of the details on it, he says that it could be from an officer or, as he puts it, a gentleman, which in my mind means that he can't really confirm its military in origin. Now, he probably said that as much, but we got to kind of piece together what was said here through the editing. So the other item, this silver piece, Emma says is indeed made of silver. In fact, she makes a point of saying it's quote unquote pure silver. They think, again, just from looking at it, some kind of decorative piece, not something with a practical application. But again, they simply don't know what it is from looking at it. And even though both Emma and Laird agreed that it is intact, meaning this is the whole piece as it was made right here, when the silver was formed, it was made into this piece right here. Nothing is broken off. It's intact. But they just don't know what it is. It just doesn't seem to fit anything in their knowledge frame, right? So what follows is a lot of talk about this silver piece being treasure. In fact, Rick makes a really cool mention of how the government would actually put this under the blanket of their treasure trove license because it's made of silver. And then there's a bunch of chatter about William Phipps, how maybe this is part of the Oak Island treasure, and Jack going on about how the original depositors might have, I don't know, hung out over here at Lot 5 while digging the money pit all the way over on the other side. You know, the only thing I could say to that is if that's true, couldn't they have found a closer place to do that to the money pit than Lot 5? And if it's, you know, and also, I mean, if this is what we're looking at, Phipps and the 1700s, why are we still talking about the Templars? Can we stop doing that now? No, we cannot stop doing that. And after the break, we're going to do exactly that, talk a lot more about the Knights Templar. Okay, we're going to end the podcast with a crackpot session in the war room. Usually we have a lot we can add to these sessions, and I tend to go on and on about them. But honestly, there's not a lot here for me to expand on, but we've got some things. So a researcher named John Edwards has come to the war room. He's meeting with members of the team about a theory that he's formulating over years, connecting information the Templars had on where they hid the Ark of the Covenant to the Freemasons. Does it make sense? It's a complicated theory, made more complicated by some seriously rough editing, which at least it seemed to me left a lot out in regards to really important information. So again, what he's saying is that the, well, I'll put it this way. Edwards describes himself by saying he, quote, spent the last 30 years studying symbols and icons with emphasis on that kind of Knights Templar through the age of exploration. That's how he said it. And he kind of said it like with emphasis on that kind of, you know, Knights Templar through the age of exploration. And I'm already kind of lost even when he gets to this because, I mean, I know a little bit about history, I think. I'm no expert, but the age of exploration was the 15th century to the 17th century. The Knights Templar were disbanded in the beginning of the 14th century, 100 years before the age of exploration. So like I said, I'm already confused after just his first sentence of what, where he's going with this. He then says, based on my research, and this is a quote, based on my research, I believe I've decoded from early Masonic texts something that I think is relevant to Oak Island. He then presents the team with something that's called The Constitutions of the Freemasons, which is a book that dates back to to 1737. And the implication here, I think, is that within this book, there is evidence of some secret knowledge that Oak Island is where the Knights Templar brought and buried the Ark of the Covenant. And he also adds that some very small group of people had this knowledge, knew that the Knights Templar did this, and passed that information down, kept it secret, by the way, but passed it down through the centuries from the Templars to the Rosicrucians and then to the Freemasons. Of course, again, there's a few hundred year gap there he's glossing over between the Templars and the Rosicrucians. But I guess we just got to get past that and kind of soldier on here. He then presents the team with something called the Royal Ark Ode, the Royal Arch Ode, which is like a poem or a hymn that I guess the Masons would recite during ceremonies. I don't know. I'm not a Mason. Now, according to the narration, Edwards thinks that this poem contains, quote, encoded information that only high-ranking members of the organization can understand, end quote. Now, the first problem is this ode is not from the Constitution of the Freemasons in 1734. So he presents us that he's going to show us this book, but then he gives us an ode that's not from the book because this is from the early 1800s. It's really strange. But the other problem is so much is left out here. Just in this description, who are these high-ranking members? How high-ranking do you have to be to have this secret information and pass it down over the centuries? Why would they pass down this incredibly important information through a poem that you and I could read on a television show? They could hide the ability to decode the poem, but they don't hide the poem itself? That doesn't make any sense. It just seems a little strange to me. I'll apologize now, but I'm going to sound snarky here with this one. Just to be clear, a lot of my blame for my sort of snarkiness and attitude on all this, I think, falls on the editors and not on Mr. Edwards. Let me just make that clear. So next, he shows a drawing. And from and this is, again, from what he calls an early Masonic text of someone, presumably a Mason, being lowered underground and pulling up something that looks vaguely like how the Ark of the Covenant is described in the Bible, although not really, since the biblical description says that the Ark of the Covenant was something like 4 feet long, had to be carried by multiple people because of how heavy it was, plated in gold and all this. But what this guy is grabbing here in this drawing looks more like he's pulling up a toy chest or something like that. And nor does he give us, nor does Mr. Edwards give us any context of any of this. He doesn't tell us exactly which early Masonic text this drawing is from. He doesn't give us any idea of why this drawing was made and where in the book this would belong and anything like that. Nothing. But I'll admit, I'll play along a little bit here. This is indeed a drawing of someone being lowered down into a hole. And it, even though the drawing's kind of wonky, the hole is obviously supposedly been made by pickaxes and shovels. You can see them holding that. And they're down there to grab a box. Okay, I get that. So then he presents some more books with some more sort of sketchy deciphering that he does. It's not very clear, again, most likely from the editing what any of this has to do with Oak Island or even the Freemasons for that matter. And he does a lot of underlining these letters, attaching meaning to things that may or may not actually mean anything. And it's all kind of confusing and convoluted. I mean, at the bottom of one of these pages, just as an example, of some unknown early Masonic text, he shows us that what's included is the number 137. And he says that it is, quote, significant because 137 is the 33rd prime number and has a reference to Masonry. And that's all he says. That's it. Are you kidding me? It's a prime number? And some possible unstated, mind you, reference to Masonry included there? And this is supposed to be evidence to me that the Ark of the Covenant is buried on Oak Island? This was a weird one. Just so you don't think I'm picking on just this one thing, this 137, he next says that within the books, there are two names of Freemasons who were some of the first Freemasons to ever live in Nova Scotia. Now, he says those names are, quote unquote, decoded, which I get to mean that they weren't actually written in those books, but they were written in some sort of code that Mr. Edwards has deciphered. Yet we never see what this code is. We never see how he went about actually decoding them either. It's maddening. But the best part comes when he presents an image of a drawing that he says, quote, I received this sketched map, which came from a book I don't own, which I find very compelling because there is a map drawn of Oak Island. Now, it is a map of Oak Island. There's no doubt about that, because it also happens to include the post-1760 property divisions. So obviously, this is not from some ancient text, which is what we were talking about before. And it's not even early Masonic text, because it's got to be from, you know, the 1780s, which is early in the world of Freemasonry, but not 1734. You get where I'm going with this. So what is it? What's the book? Who drew it? Unbelievably, we never learn any of that. So when Edwards concludes the scene by saying, quote, so if all the clues are correct, the message being conveyed in code is that the Ark of the Covenant is here. I mean, at this point, guys, I'm scratching my head and stopping myself from yelling at the television, something like, what the heck are you talking about? There was no evidence I could see of anything in this. This was so weirdly edited. It was very frustrating. It's very frustrating for me to get these kind of cool theories and look into history and stuff, and then have the show just chop it up so much to the point where I can't even understand where this guy's coming up with this idea. So there's a lot of smiling and nodding when he next says he could probably figure out where it is and launches into this diatribe about the Tree of Life symbol and Nolan's Cross. All very similar to the work of Peter Amundsen. He was the Norwegian organist who thinks the location of the Temple of Treasure is actually hidden and coded within the original folios of William Shakespeare, which, according to this organist, Shakespeare didn't actually write himself. If you want to give yourself a migraine, go read about that theory. Now, the only reason, according to this episode, that Edwards believes the Templars created a Tree of Life on Oak Island out of these humongous, barely movable stones to hide the treasure is that the Templars, who were held in the prison in France, carved the Tree of Life symbol on the walls of their cell. Of course, they also carved 100 other things on there, but I guess the tree is the only one that's important here. Now, all this time in my mind, I'm thinking it's not all lost, right? Edwards, despite presenting what is little or no evidence to support his theory, asks for and is granted permission to explore the island and try, I suppose, to locate the Ark. But, because he says he's going to put down multiple X's for them to dig. And it all sounds a lot like what Peter Amundsen said when he was on the island, if you ask me. And if you're not familiar with that, just go back and watch season 1, episode 4, and you can kind of get up to speed on that. But and you can watch it on history.com. Now, again, the good news here is that not the X's, not his theory. I don't have any reason to believe any of that. But instead, it seems like, along with a line put in the closing narration, it seems like what we're going to get is an exploration, maybe even this season, and an examination of the boulders that create Nolan's Cross. And guys, we've been waiting a decade for this. It looks like we might finally get something like this. We shall see. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the Diggin' Oak Island podcast. Don't forget, you can really help keep the show going by becoming a patron. If you think the show is worth $5 a month to you, then head on over to patreon.com/diggin' oak island to learn more. And if you prefer, you can also make a one-time donation to the podcast via Venmo. Just use the username at Dave McBride Music. If you want to help out the podcast in another way, then you could do so by giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your shows. Big thanks to everyone who's done that. Thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to do that and for the kind words. Don't forget, you can follow the show on Facebook. Just put at Diggin' Oak Island in your search bar. And if you have any questions or comments you want to send directly to me, best place to do it is via email, digginoakisland@gmail.com. And as I always like to tell you, keep in mind, if you don't want your message or your email read aloud, please let me know because I will probably answer it here on the podcast. So make a note of that. If you don't want me to answer it on the podcast, I'll do my best to answer you via email. All right, folks, it's crown time. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Diggin' Oak Island.